Thank you for joining us for live paranormal radio. From the paranormal to the unexplained, it all happens here.
It all happens here.
Looking to enhance your radio experience? Participate in our live video chat 24/7 with our live paranormal radio show hosts and other like-minded people. Live. Paranormal.com, the only interactive social chat room supported by Full Interaction Media. Stop by now and join the fun.
Stop by now and join the fun.
It's raising the vibration on the Live Paranormal Radio Network. Please join us at liveparanormal.com and all of our affiliates, iHeartRadio.com, Google Podcasts, iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, Podomatic, Blog Talk Radio, Player FM. The list goes on and on. I only can memorize so many times. I do the best I can do. Hi, I'm your host, Sheena Metal. I'm a psychic medium. I'm an interfaith minister. I'm a 27-year talk radio host. And I come to you live every Tuesday at 5 o'clock Pacific time from Los Angeles, California, which has been my home for over 40 years. So hard to believe. So this show was the first outreach of a nonprofit movement of peace and love and kindness and unity that I founded in 2016 after my mom's death to carry on her teachings, both spiritual and humane, and try to put into the world more peace, more love, more kindness, more unity, and more vibrational ascension, which were things that she really thought humanity needed. In addition to those four cornerstone words, this show, Raising the Vibration, the radio show, is about ascension, evolvement, inspiration, and again, love. So basically, what are you doing every day to raise your own vibration? And then how is that leading to your ultimate spiritual evolvement? And then what are you doing with those two wonderful things? How are you using them to inspire other people to send the elevator down and bring up 100 people, as the case may be? And then how much love are you throwing into the world? That's one of the most important things. How much love are you throwing into the world? So every week on the show, I grab people that I think are beautiful, that I think are an example of vibration raising that make my soul warm, and will do the same when you hear their wonderful voices and you hear their stories. And my guest today is no exception to that. She is a wonderfully talented author and speaker and performer of a solo performance, what we used to call the one-woman show. And she's just funny and wonderful and spiritual and fantastic and a healer. And I know you're going to love hearing her on the show once again, as she returns here to Raising the Vibration. Please welcome my friend Fiona Goodwin is here. How are you, my friend? How are you doing?
Hi, Sheena. That is one hell of an introduction. That's amazing. No pressure.
Thank you.
No pressure at all.
No pressure at all, but you're totally going to live up to it. You know that. No pressure at all, my friend.
Oh, yes, sweet.
Just, I think that everybody in life, you know, people go through life and they put up memes that say things like, this is the time in my life mm-hmm. when I'm cutting out toxic people, or I'm letting things go. If you're not in my life, you know what I mean? For me, this is the time in my life where the people that matter to me are the people who are interested in putting their own soul into the world and trying to make the everything better, trying to lift up the whole of everything. I think as we all make that middle age shift where we go, I'm not taking this anymore, you become like the get off my lawn lady. For me, it's about get off my lawn if you're not working to raise the vibration of the world, you know?
Right. No, I love that. And I hope to be one of those people that doesn't have to be told to get off the lawn. Somebody else, maybe.
I will never tell you to get off the lawn or you wouldn't be here. But, yeah, I mean, it's
right.
You know, I think that you can really break humanity down, you know, macrocosmically into two kinds of people. People that care only
mm-hmm.
about themselves, and people that understand
right.
that we're just a tiny part of the everything and care about
yeah.
what's going on with everyone, right? That your journey is also my journey.
Right. No, that's beautifully put. Beautifully put. And you know, I think addressing our own, I'm sorry, but I've been absolutely obsessed with the Amber Heard, Johnny Depp case, forgive me, but it's been so fascinating seeing people put out into the world for all to see all of that dirty laundry. And I think about all the dirty laundry that we all have and those conversations that we think, oh, God, you know, I hope nobody ever hears me in this light. I hope nobody ever sees me like this. And so it's been kind of fascinating, especially in terms of, you know, the idea of a man being a victim, which I think is it's the Me Too movement, you know, gone the other way, which I think needed to happen, you know, because men
I think it needed to happen too. I agree with you.
Yeah. Because I just don't think that only somebody like Johnny Depp with his resources and his popularity could actually come out and say, and a lot of courage, and say, you know, I'm a victim. I'm not saying that he's done everything perfectly, because of course he hasn't. But that makes him just another human being, doesn't it?
It makes it, right, exactly. And I think Me Too was so important because there are ways in which the patriarchy needed to be corralled because of the cultural okay that white men could do whatever they wanted because they were white men. And I think that time had to come. Mm-hmm. But I said all the way through that, and I say now that darkness and negativity and narcissism and sociopathy, these are not gender-specific things. They're not ethnic-specific things. They're not spiritually specific things. I mean, anybody in a human body can be wrong on the inside. And we need to make sure that we believe men when they're saying this one is crazy, in the same way that it's important we believe women when they say this one is crazy or violent or dangerous or I'm scared. You know, we're women. We know women can be hella scary if the wiring's not right.
But also we've also been given a kind of an open invitation to say whatever we want about men, thinking that this will never be, we'll never be questioned about it. So that's my pro men statement for the day.
Yay, up with humans. Yeah, we don't have any right to judge an entire group of people. We have to remember that we're humans because on the inside, right? And look, we've been here for 3 minutes and now I'm getting woo-woo. On the inside, we are all a mixture of our divine masculine and our divine feminine, right? Everybody is. So just because somebody is biologically male or female doesn't mean that spiritually they are necessarily what you think, because everybody inside is a combination. And maybe it took Johnny Depp, who's kind of a soft-spoken, sweeter, falls a little bit more in the middle kind of a guy, for people to go, oh, yeah, maybe sometimes, you know, people are just wired wrong and they abuse their spouses and it's not always a one-way thing. And I think that's so important to know, because I just think it's important that we corral the narcissist as much as we can and not allow them to get away with what they can get away with and not give them the attention. And you can see in that trial, I mean, and from all the evidence that's coming out, that, you know, there is a certain kind, many kinds, right, of personality disorders that are just attention-seeking. It's very much like when you're in the paranormal world and you're dealing with spirits, speaking to them or doing a spirit investigation in a house. There are spirits that are just attention-seeking, and they'll do anything for attention. And I think poor Johnny Depp has been guilty of feeding the troll in the past, not knowing maybe how dangerous the troll was. Because I think when someone attacks you, you naturally sort of, you know, get your dander up and go after them. I think it's normal. If somebody's attacking you, you fight back. It's our fight or flight mechanism, right?
Yeah, but also, you know, a true narcissist is able to woo us, you know, and able to kind of create an amazing image and presence, and we get seduced. And if we're a little bit vulnerable in our own, you know, in our own way or in our own self-esteem or whatever, we become, you know, we become fans of the narcissist, and then it takes a lot for us to go, oh my goodness, I really, really got that very wrong. You know, especially when we consider ourselves to be really good judges of character, it's terrible when we find out, oh dear, I got that so wrong. That's part of us doing our own excavation and finding out, okay, so why was I vulnerable to that? What made me a prey to that? Because it takes two to tango. So.
Absolutely. You know. Well, I think it's a couple things. I think narcissists have a tendency to, I mean, I think it's in their genetic design to find empaths like the wise men found Jesus. You know, I mean, it's like, we're like we have a tracking device and they come after us. And I think as empaths, we're always wanting to heal and help. So when we see a person that we thought was amazing and then suddenly we start to see the flaws, we immediately think, well, this is a damaged person who needs my help. And I think the trick with, and I think that was very much the case in the Johnny Depp Amber Heard marriage as well. And I think your own survival as an empath, right, is to get to the place where you decide, where do you stop helping and start running for your own survival? Because we're not supposed to sacrifice ourselves in order to try to help somebody who, one, doesn't want to be helped, and two, doesn't maybe really even have it in their makeup to be helped. I mean, you work in the world of spirituality and of psychology. So do you believe that narcissists can be cured?
Don't tell any narcissist that you know, but I haven't known a narcissist to be cured.
No.
And I think part of that is because, I think part of that is because there are many different reasons for becoming a narcissist, but abandonment and deep, deep low self-esteem are very difficult to heal. So you have to be able to get to that stuff in order to, and the thing is there are too many of us around, and I include myself in this, maybe have a little bit of hubris about, the idea, because I'm a psychotherapist, so, you can, if you're not careful, think, oh, I'm going to be the one, I'm going to be the one who's going to help this person.
Of course.
We can get caught up in our own, our own grandiosity, and that's where, that's where we come a cropper.
I agree, and I can say that, right, and they play on that. They play on the fact that you think that.
Yeah, I mean, there are just an all-round good thing for people who have a little, who think they're the greatest, especially for psychologists and psychotherapists who think, or just, civilians who meet a narcissist and think, I'm going to be the one. I'm going to be the one to fix them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to be able to one to reach them. And then you find out, well, they're just better at it. They're better at being a narcissist than you are at being an empath. So that's a humbling, humbling process, which I've certainly been through.
Yeah, I always say that when I teach workshops about empathy and about narcissism, and I teach both, that an empath always says, what did I do? We always question, right? What did I do? What could I have done different? A narcissist always says, what did you do? What could you have done different? So we wind up taking responsibility for all our stuff and all their stuff, and they don't take any responsibility. And from a spiritual perspective, I believe that sometimes narcissism is nature and sometimes it's nurture, because I think sometimes it's just a disease of the soul. Because you'll find people that there's just no reason for it, no abandonment, no, it doesn't seem to come from anywhere. It just is.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with you. I have never known a real narcissist, a true narcissist, not somebody who is narcissistic or has a narcissistic quality, but a true narcissist mm-hmm. I have never known to get better. And I guess luckily for me, I knew so many from the entertainment world that by the time I opened my spiritual practice, I knew I wasn't ever going to save one. So I think that's a good thing, because part of the battle, I think, is going back to the Johnny Depp Amber Heard thing again, right, is getting to the place where you realize I'm not doing any good here and I just have to walk away.
Right. And the thing is about a narcissist, there will always be one more person that wants to be a sycophant or somebody who's, you know, I find often in my work with clients that there is an underlying, especially those that are in relationship to narcissists, there's an underlying apology for being alive, you know. It's like they just, you know, the people that are victims of narcissists, you know, they just, there's something about them that just says, you know, I'm sorry. You know, there's just a constant apology going on. The reason existing, you know.
Right. Well, I think it's constantly being demanded.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know what I mean? They're constantly being asked to apologize.
Yeah. So can I change the subject and ask you a question about your work?
Mm. Absolutely.
So when you meet people, can you feel spirits around them?
If I'm looking for
them. Or is that something you have to tune in? If you have to tune into, gotcha.
No, if I'm looking for them. I'm not always, so this is the thing. I always say, Fiona, that I'm an empath first. So when I meet someone, I instantly feel them. What's going on with them? What's happening with them?
Right.
What are they feeling right now?
Mm-hmm.
If I occasionally, a spirit will reach out and grab me and say, pay attention to me. If there is some darkness in them or maybe a spirit attachment they're carrying, that is a very visceral thing, so you can feel that very easily. But just tapping into everyday grandma and grandpa and Uncle Ben, and that is really looking for them. I can see them, but I don't always go looking for them because I find it distracting from tapping into what's going on with the person. But if somebody says to me, are there any spirits around me? I mean, of course I can go and find them. But most people, they're just kind of hanging around in various levels of accessibility to be tapped into, depending on whether or not some of the living want to talk to them. Occasionally one will really have some kind of an agenda and really need to pass a message, and they'll jump right in your face. But mostly they're just sort of like, you know, grandma and grandpa, like, come visit us when you're not busy, dear. You know, it's like that kind of a thing. what hits me and knocks me on my ass is what's going on inside of people. And sometimes it can be a lot. And I have gone to great pains in my life because, you know, even before I hung my shingle out, I still suffered as an empath. To make sure that I put, like, screens and filters up if I can feel that somebody is in so much crisis that they're very draining. And they don't mean to be draining. They're just trying to, you know, it's like somebody drowning, right? Drowning man will sometimes drown their helper. So you just have to be careful sometimes with that. And it also depends on me. I have to make sure that I stay well-nutritioned and well-slept and less stressed, so that when I encounter somebody and it is a lot like that, it doesn't affect my physicality. You know?
I love it. Yeah. I love the Netflix series that Tyler Henry did. And, you know, the Hollywood medium, calls himself a Hollywood medium. And but he talks about the overwhelm of constant voices, constant clamoring, you know? And that must be very hard to deal with. But I guess we, like you say, we all experience it in some ways. If we have any level of intuition, we just, when we meet people, we either feel a kind of a mass of, like, issues, or, you know, we feel a lightness or a clarity, or I think we're all just a lot more empathic than, or intuitive maybe than we realize.
Right. And it's a muscle. The more you use it, the more it happens.
Right.
The more it's, you know, people will say to me, I'm trying to work on my spiritual gifts, and now I'm miserable every day. And I say, well, you know, you've taken the channel from what was probably the circumference of a garden hose, and now it's the circumference of a drain pipe. Well, you've been stretching it out. And the bigger it is, the more messages come through faster. So that's why you need the screens and the filters, and you have to be careful how fast you open up. It's different for me, I guess, because my mom was a psychic medium and a therapist. And even though she was very in the closet about her gifts until I was in college, I still was raised with them. You know, just because somebody doesn't tell you what they are, they're still raising you with the ideals of it. And I think she taught me how to protect myself for the most part from that, sort of what empathy was, and didn't make me feel like I was crazy because I felt so much. Because a lot of people, I think, when they open up and they really start to discover their empathic gifts, they go back and look at their life and, you know, how many people told you, you're too dramatic, you feel too much, why can't you just get over it, why does everything mean so much to you, how come you're so sensitive? And the answer to all those questions is empath. And I tell my clients that are newly acknowledging their empathy that are, and again, there's a difference in having empathy and being an empath. The clients that are empaths, that it's, you know, I always say when I teach my empath workshop, congratulations, you're an empath, and my condolences, you're an empath. But it goes from being the biggest hindrance in your life to becoming the most beautiful thing in your life. It's just you have to learn how to deal with it, you know? I'm sorry?
Well, I was going to say you have to have sufficient self-esteem to be able to put your own life jacket on first or whatever, your own oxygen mask on first.
Right.
Instead of going down with the ship. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Do you teach people to develop their psychic skills, or do you just work with people? Wow.
No, I teach people how to develop their gifts, but I also teach people how to deal with their gifts, because I think sometimes people go and take classes, like the big thing is everybody always wants to know how to open their third eye, right? How do I open my third eye?
Right.
And then, you know, oh, I'm going to this class to learn to open my third eye. And they always say, be careful. And then, you know, 2 weeks later, they're calling me in hysterics. Why can't I sleep? Why can I hear the cat's heart beating? Well, you know what?
Oh, my God.
You open that third eye. So you have to do it slowly, and you have to do it in it's like getting a tan, right? You don't just rub baby oil all over yourself and go sit out by the sun for 12 hours on the hottest day of the year, because you wind up in the hospital. You put the suntan lotion on, you go for an hour, then 3-4 days later you go for an hour. It's the same thing when you're conditioning your third eye to be open. You open it a little bit, and then you get used to it, then you open it a little bit. But people don't often teach that. People act like it's just a switch that you flip, and then, oh, isn't it wonderful when you flip it and you become this oracle, and then you just skip through the meadow for the rest of your life and have no problems. Well, you know, when you open up that part of yourself, you're dealing with a whole separate part of yourself that you haven't had your whole life. Like, you know, our whole lives, many of us, our whole lives have had six senses, and we've been working on them since the day we were born, probably even in utero.
Mm-hmm.
So now you're 30, 40, 60, however old you are, and now you're opening up a brand new sense that you didn't have your entire life to get used to. And you just have to be careful with it. I mean, I think with anything, and I'm this way too. I, you know, go big or go home. I'm Irish. I think that we have a tendency to overcorrect, right? We get excited about something, and then it's like, oh, my God, I'm going to do that. And then we're doing it 400%, and then we wind up dealing with the ramifications of doing things too quickly. And I think we do that in nutritional changes. We do it in psychological changes. We do it in spiritual changes. I just basically think it's how we are. You know, it's what human beings do. And so it's all about moderation, right? Like Buddha said about, I love Buddha's quote about moderation, that if the guitar string is too tight, it snaps. If it's too loose, it won't play. You've got to find that middle place And you really need to find that sweet spot if you're going to continue to grow your gifts, because it's already going to be a lot without, you know, you doing it too quickly or the wrong way.
Right. Well, we do love a shortcut, don't we? You know,
sure.
We all do.
I do.
Yeah, exactly. And I love all these things on, you know, you see on YouTube and on TikTok, you know, what they call life hacks, you know, these things that teach you how to put your socks on, that kind of thing, quickly. It's all sorts of funny things. How to cut a melon, how to cut a pineapple, how to, you know, I can't remember any of them, but I'm sure they're very useful.
Well, you can open your third eye fast, but you just have to do it a little bit at a time. I mean, it doesn't take years and years and years for it to open. And people will call me and say, you know, I can't sleep. I'm feeling everybody's stuff. And, you know, they'll give me this long list of stuff. And at the end, they'll say, and why isn't my third eye opening? And I start laughing. And I think, honey, if you got all these problems, it's already open wide and you're fine. I don't know what people think is going to happen when it opens, like the angels are going to sing, or I'm not sure. But if you are feeling all the pains of empathy, it's probably open wide, and you need to learn how to slap a screen on it, you know?
Right. So what do you think of you know, the effect on the psyche of this country, of the events of, I hope you don't mind me bringing it to this, of the children and the teachers that have been lost, and the fact that, you know, it's again and again and again, you know?
Yeah, I think it's causing permanent psychological damage to the pulse of our country. I believe we're a country that never properly even healed from 9/11. I think the malaise and the depression of what the PTSD that we dealt with after 9/11, you know, Pearl Harbor was awful, but it was also thousands of miles away. It was our country, but it wasn't in our face. But New York is our heart. I mean, it really is the heart of the country. And for something like that to happen, and so many to die instantly, we have never gotten over that. And so I think every time there's a shooting like this, worse when it's kids, worse when it's old people, but no matter who it is, it just continues to sort of, it's just another abusive situation that falls on top of that PTSD that's already there. And I think we're all having a very hard time. And I'm very thankful for social media. And I know social media, is your best friend and your worst enemy. But I'm very thankful for social media because it's a place where people can just say, I'm scared, I'm freaked out, this isn't okay with me, I can't sleep. And the first step for healing is being able to talk about it, and not keep it all inside where it becomes destructive. But I think from a spiritual perspective, I mean, I think we're in the battle for our lives, It's there's always a balance of good and evil in this world, and the universe, and it sometimes it tips one way and sometimes it tips another, and this is the time for you to walk into the light, stay in the light, do what you can to help others, and tip the balance over to light as much as you can, because there's a lot going on right now, and to me it all starts with the spiritual, and then the spiritual affects the psychological, which then affects the intellectual, then sometimes affects people's physicality, So this mindset, if you're not happy with your life, you just go to your school and shoot up all your classmates. It's a sociological and spiritual sickness, every bit as much as a psychological illness of whoever that person is, you know?
I mean, I think that I used to work. Can you hear me okay?
I can, yeah.
Are you there? Okay, good. I used to work with adolescents with behavioral issues, and, you know, there are some kids that are set up in such a way in their lives that shooting up a classroom seems to make sense. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's like I'm not
yeah.
justifying it, making it right. But if in terms of the spiritual, if only we could learn to walk in each other's shoes and to take the time with children to walk in their shoes and to really have a good, clear understanding. And if there were multi-agencies that, you know, were equipped and, you know, if there was money for that instead of money for the stupid things, like, you know,
yeah.
It's been fascinating to me. I love the fact that the other day in Europe, you know, the big news was that, you know, and it was across the whole of Europe, the big news is that someone had thrown a cake at, you know, in the Louvre. They'd thrown a cake at the, oh my goodness, I can't remember her name now. But you know what I'm saying. It's called, in French, she's called La Joconde, which is no good to anybody.
Yeah.
The Mona Lisa, thank you. The Mona
yeah.
Lisa. And that was the big news. You know, that
yeah.
I mean, and she was behind glass anyway, but that was the big news in Europe, as you know, compared to the big news here in America. Amazing.
Yeah. No, I remember when in the
sure.
90s, my ex-boyfriend and I loved to watch the show Cops, and it was because he considered it like a psychological experiment to watch the criminals and how the cops reacted to them. So one day we were watching Cops, and it was Cops in London, and I don't know if officers in London still don't carry guns, but at this time they did not. So they're on the door and
right.
they're banging and the guy's screaming and it's like some meth head or something. And
yeah.
the lady officer, sir, if you don't open the door, we're going to have to continue to speak harshly to you. And, you know, Paul and I just cracked up because we thought, oh, my God, in this country, the guns would have already been out. Somebody's kneecap would have been shot off. But her whole thing was, you know, don't make me come back there and speak harshly. And it worked. The
right.
guy opened the door. It worked. And we thought, what would it be like to live in a place where
right.
that's the final gun you pull out? And it worked. So I think
uh-huh.
that, you know, I think violence begets violence, right? The more that happens here,
yeah.
the more we think it's okay. It becomes our bar for what's okay.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just
I know that they do have machine guns outside Buckingham Palace because
right.
my mother and I were there one day just before the day before the Jubilee, and I might have told this story before, but I desperately wanted my mother to see the Queen again because she was at the actual coronation of the Queen in 19
cool.
whatever it was, and
right.
so my mother was, you know, kind of, she was sort of not on her way out exactly, but it would be the last time, you know, that she would. Anyway, we were standing at the
right.
gate of Buckingham Palace, and a policeman with a machine gun, and this is the difference between the relationship with the police here and there, the policeman said to us, madam, to my mother, madam, if you would mind moving onto the pavement away from the gates. And my mother just said, why? She didn't move. She said, why? Why should we? And he said, madam, please, would you move away from the gates? And she said, yeah, but why? Why have I got, you know, she wasn't, this is a man, big man standing there with a machine gun. And then and he said, he winked and he said, madam, please move away from the gate and you might want to get your camera out. And so we hustled to the side of the gate, and before we knew it, the Queen was coming out in her Bentley and
wow.
gave my mother a little wave, which was so sweet. But what
oh.
a difference, right? I mean, you
yeah.
wouldn't speak to somebody standing outside the White House like that, would you?
Well,
I'll give you an
example of the difference here, right? I have a friend
uh-huh.
that fronted a popular band in the 80s who just happened to play my grad night at Disneyland. So when we first met and realized, I was like, hey, your band played my grad night, and we started kicking up a conversation. And she said, do you know, behind the scenes at Disneyland, they all carry machine guns. So,
wow, really?
You know, here, guards were armed even in the 80s at a theme park. I mean, you know, granted, Disneyland is the theme park, but at a theme park.
Wow.
Wow. But, you know, you know, you, she's like, it's just so happy, and it's Mickey Mouse, and it smells like popcorn, and you go backstage with Michelle. So I
wow.
just think that's the difference. And I wonder if, and I love my country. I always have. I'm from one of the original 13 colonies. I'm so proud to be here. But you wonder sometimes, uh-huh. again, if that just becomes the bar of what's okay. And then it just escalates and escalates and escalates, as I really believe it has, you know. And maybe they have to at Disneyland, because if they didn't, somebody would get shot there. I mean, maybe there's a reason for that level of protection.
Well, there's
but,
so many
I mean,
people that if somebody went in with an AR-15 into Disneyland, I mean, they could decimate so many people in one go, couldn't they? Because it's so crowded most of the time. That would be just terrible.
I mean, I worry about, I mean, look, depression is a worldwide condition. Anxiety is a worldwide condition. Insecurity is a worldwide condition. But I just worry sometimes about the level of anger. And you can't say it's all video games, because people have video games all over the world. People watch TV and movies all over the world. I just think that there's it's almost like we've caught an illness here. And, it's this epidemic that we need to work on in the same way that we had to work on the COVID epidemic, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I heard this morning that America has 400 million guns, you know, that many guns out there. So it would be much more difficult to do what they did in Australia or in New Zealand than what they're doing in Canada now.
Sure.
You know, it would be almost
exactly.
impossible. But what is it?
Yeah.
I mean, is it because, I don't know, is it, can we blame the cowboys? You know, that early lifestyle of the people taking over the Native American land and all of that.
Well, but
and there's been no...
I mean, that happened all over South America, right? That happened all over the islands. It happened in Africa and in
mm-hmm.
India. I mean, colonization is no... I mean, that's a thing. It's not just here. You know, I think part of it, I don't know. I mean, I think part of it may be with the fact that, and this is horrible to say, that you know, a lot of people that didn't fit in where they were either came here or got sent here.
Right.
I think it still becomes a refuge for people who don't feel good about where they're from. They come here. But the same could be
right.
said for Canada.
Well,
I think that...
Well, Australians were all were convicts. So, you know, Australia
right,
got the people
totally
who were being
so
sent over.
Right, exactly. I mean, I think it's just a lot of... I mean, I think some of it has to do with maybe convicts are more mellow than religious fanatics. I mean, this place was founded by a lot of really extreme religious people. And if you
right.
Live by the Bible word for word, and I have nothing against the Bible, but I believe it's allegorical. If you look at the Bible and you follow every word, I mean, the Old Testament, there's a lot of stuff in there about smiting and killing and burning. And I think
mm-hmm.
maybe there was an anger that existed there, and it's carried down. Interesting, I remember when I was in college, and I lived in Orange County, which was at the time extremely Christian and white and conservative, and I mean, it still has the remnants of that, but it's so different now. My mom and I had season tickets at what was the theater in Orange County, and we went and saw a version of As You Like It, Shakespeare's As You Like It, and there was a thing in the program all about why Shakespeare has never really taken off in the United States the way it has in practically every other country in the world. And in this, and this was like, I don't know, maybe 1989 that I was reading this, it said that the
mm-hmm.
the reason for that is that because of the Puritans, we still have that Puritan ethic. And Shakespeare had a freeness and a bawdiness and a randiness and, you
right.
know, breaking the social stereotypes. And it's still very poo-pooed here because even though those people are long gone and even though the people in this country that are here currently may even say they're not religious, they don't believe, they're not Christians. There's an energy that has carried down from the 1500s. And culturally, you can still visually feel that in this country. It's kind of like this, to be lovely, but, you know, if men are naked on film in this country, they almost always are wearing a fake penis over their penis. I can tell you what every – did you not know that? That's a thing.
I did not know that.
I can pretty much draw every British actor's penis from memory because you see it like every film. So there's a fear, right? Now we'll exploit women, even women. You think women wear the merkins and you know what I mean? I mean it's okay to show somebody, you know, like Saw stuck in a rat trap, but it's not okay to show somebody's natural body. And even when people are naked, they have the pressure, both male and female, to augment their bodies to look a certain way. So there's a whole thing about natural nudity that's so different here than in other places in the world. And I think that's that Puritan ethic, right? Floating right down.
Right. Yeah. I remember I was, when in my younger days, I was a very, very zealous, fundamental, born-again Christian. And I'm better now, but I remember going to, you know, I was on this missionary team, and I remember being in the dormitory with all these other women. I guess I was in my late 20s, and I was wearing, you know, underwear that was just like, for me, it's just like normal underwear. And they were all wearing these great big things that came sort of this. It felt like they went down to their knees and up to their, you know, up to the bra, because it was just, they were just wearing
bloomers.
These huge underpants. What are they called?
Like bloomers.
What are they called?
They wore in the Victorian.
Yeah, like bloomers.
What?
Yeah, and they like bloomers. And we changed communally. It wasn't a big deal, but I remember them seeing my underpants and being absolutely horrified that I was wearing these. I mean, they considered them to be indecent. And they were.
Yeah.
I wasn't wearing a G-string or anything like that. I was just wearing regular underpants, or what I thought were anyway. But that's, I was so shocked partly because, you know, I grew up watching American movies, and you don't get that. You don't, you know, from the movies, you don't get that conservative sort of feel, you know.
Right.
So it was quite shocking. Yeah.
Yeah, it's it's a thing, and I think it's a thing that we're still trying to work on. It's it's something that we as a society are trying to heal from, but you know, heal from 500 years later. I mean, that's a long time to not have progressed, and I think in a lot of ways we have. I mean, we're the United States of America. We have probably, Hollywood probably puts out more, you know, crazy, sexy movies than any place else in the world. But it depends on the way it's done. And it's all done from a very exploitative way. And it's very different. So let's say you see an American film and there's going to be, four women bouncing up and down in a shower, and they all have enormous boob jobs, and and there's three guys behind the shower masturbating and looking at them. British film, you see five actors in a Victorian set film, and they're all naked, and they're bathing in a river. You know what I mean? It's not set out to be exploitative. It's just, here are people in their natural thing, and hey, guess what? If there's no one around and you're in the river, you're all going to take your clothes off and no one cares.
Wow.
So I think they're seeking that freedom that, you know, where it's not done in such a, because when you're showing the girls in the shower and the guys peeping around the corner, it still has a little bit of a sex is bad underlying tone to it. Oh, see how nasty it is? It's nasty. If a bunch of people are just in a river bathing, and some of those, you see some A-list actors, and I say this because I watch a lot of British films and I watch a lot of Canadian films and a lot of Australian films. You see a lot of big-name actors completely naked and not caring. And that's so natural, right? Because that makes it it becomes a nothing burger. It becomes a non-issue. It just becomes natural. Mm-hmm. It's not weird and titillating and freaky. I think we need to grow past that, because I think a lot of that, the social repression, the sexual repression, the cultural repression, the worry of being around others that are not just like you, whether that's the way they look or their gender or their sexuality or where they live or how much money they have. I think all of these repressions lead to pent-up emotions that can't be properly executed. And I think sometimes when an emotion can't be properly executed, that's where resentment starts. It's where violence starts, where insecurity starts, anger, all of that stuff, right? All those bad emotions come when you're not allowed to process all the thoughts in your head.
Right. So you when you come from a shame-based culture where where there's a focus, especially a focus on the physical, on the appearance, because so much of this stuff has nothing to do with, you know, who we are inside. It's all to do with, you know, what it looks like on the outside.
Right. Right. And we see that, I think, part of that is a human condition. But, and I'm going to say this again with love for my country, I think it's specifically an American condition. And I can't think of any other country in the world where people have pressure put on them to look a certain way. And especially in our media, but even not in our media, right? Even in our friend groups, and it doesn't matter if you're straight, gay, bi, trans, intersex, or the plus sign. Doesn't matter who you are or how old you are, there's always somebody who's going to be judging you for the way you look and thinking they have a right to do it. And I think that's a very bad habit that we've developed.
Right. How do you get your head around the people who, the politicians that support the NRA the way they do, and the people who, I mean, I don't know which position it was who said, who just said recently, you know, it's not, the problem isn't the gun. I think it was just yesterday somebody said that. I mean, how do they ignore it and let people, children, continue to be, you know, shot and not do anything about it? Is it because they don't get the funds from, they need the lobbyists, they need the...
Yeah, I mean, I think things like, right, two of the biggest problems in our country, right, sweetie, guns and big pharma, guns and addiction,
right.
And it's because those two areas of business are the biggest supporters financially of politicians, and I think that oftentimes, as sad as this is, a person's number one motivator over their family, over their church, over their principles, is their pocketbook. People want to make a lot of money. And the more they make, the more they decide they have to have. And they're never going to shut the NRA down because the NRA puts so much money in their pockets. And then they get, then they also, I think there's a whole other sect that, you know, the having a gun goes with your right of being religious and a Christian. And then there's, you have to have a gun to protect yourself from the other. And then there's, you know, well, it's in the Constitution. Hey, I don't have a problem that it's in the Constitution, but maybe we need to put some, you know, really very strict constraints on how and who can get a gun. I'm not here to take everybody's guns away or tell people they can't hunt. I'm not that person. I believe everyone needs to meet in the middle, not swing the pendulum too far one way or the other. But there needs to be rules for who can have a gun and why. And I think if your child, if you had guns in your house and your child got them and shot up the school, you are also criminally liable for that, because when you get a gun, you have to take responsibility for it. You know, when if you have if you're a martial artist and your hands are registered as a weapon, if you get angry one night, punch somebody in a bar, and they die, you are criminally responsible for your hands that are a weapon. Yet you're not criminally responsible for your guns in the house if they're just sitting there. They're still a weapon. You know, and you have to be careful. And I think these people like, oh, we had them in the cabinet, but, you know, he knew where the key was. Well, why? Why did a minor living in your house know where the key was?
Yeah.
Where were you watching your child when your child was developing all this isolationist, angry, resentful behaviors? And, you know, I understand it's very taboo to reach out and talk about mental illness in this world, but, you know, we need to really start doing that, because that's just a human sickness. That's our whole, that's a special problem, you know?
Right. Well, I'm hoping that that might become more, that conversation might become more and more common, because that's where the beginning, I think it's the beginning and the end, you know, of it all.
Yeah. I hope so too.
Yeah.
But it's hard running in the face of that. As healers and as artists, and you and I are both, we have to try to just pour light into everything, right? To just raise the light vibration, because we can't fix what the politicians are doing. We can't fix what parents are doing in their homes, and we can't control who buys or watches a gun that they've bought. But so we just have to kind of keep trying to cheer people up and keep people filled with light and inspire people and heal people and hope in a way that makes it better.
Right. As well as that, is our job is to own our own stuff, own our darkness, own our shadow, own our, you know, and not
absolutely
not set ourselves up in such a way that we look like something that we're not, you know. We're just human.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
All of us, even those that are human, we're just humans with an extra job.
Yeah. I love one of the Sandy Hook mothers. She lost her little boy, her 6-year-old boy, and she was saying that there are only two kind of people. There are good people, and then there are good people who are sick. And I love that. I love that description. I mean, I think there's a lot of evil out there, but, you know, I think a lot of it starts with damage. Yeah. So
I
we sorted the world
out.
Wonderful.
Which
is good.
Now, Paul, this was a great conversation. Where can people find you online? And what a joy to spend time with you again.
Oh, thank you, Andrew. www.fionagoodwin.com. My next full performance of my show, my stage play, is at the moment, it's Palm Springs, 30th of October. And then on a Friday, I do a Facebook live show, and you just go to A Very British Lesbian. A Very British Lesbian on Facebook, or Fiona Goodwin on Facebook. You can find the live shows on Facebook.
Wonderful.
So, and
do
if you,
that, my friend.
If you want the book,
it's so important.
Thank you. And if you want the book, you can go to Amazon, and it's ever so cheap.
I love that. Please go and get it, and please follow this wonderful woman who is doing her best to heal people one laugh at a time. I appreciate you, my friend. Thank you so much for being here.
You too, Sheena. Thanks. Lots of love. Ciao.
Take care. The wonderful Fiona Goodwin, everybody. If you missed those links, SheenaMetalSpiritual.com. That's my site for everything. All your psychic and spiritual needs, radio, video, stuff about me, SheenaMetalSpiritual.com. On social media, I am everywhere, just at Sheena Metal, like my name. I'm here every Tuesday and every Wednesday doing my Raising the Vibration and Haunted Playground shows, respectively. We'll be back tomorrow with Haunted Playground. That's Pacific time because I come out of L.A. Wonderful and thrilled to be a part of the Live Paranormal family, the iHeartRadio family, and all of the families that I mentioned at the beginning of the show. Till I see you next time, seek peace, live in love, lead with kindness, embrace unity, always raise your vibration, and remember that you are love and you are loved. I'll see you next time. Thank you so much for being here. It's Raising the Vibration on LifeParanormal.com.